This is an oral history interview for the Smoke Jumpers Oral History Project in Missoula on July 21st, 1984. I'd start, guys, by having you introduce yourselves.
July 22nd.
Start introducing yourself.
Okay, I'm Bob Reed. I trained in 1957 in Missoula.
And Herb Fisher, same class and same base.
Okay, guys, what made you decide to try smoke jumping?
Well, you're not going to believe this, but for me, I was a hotshot in Region 5 in California, Chester Trinity, and I got helicoptered into a fire. They landed about 3 miles from the fire, and I'm going along, and I've got a pack on my back, and I've got a pump on my back, I'm carrying tools, I'm sweating, the bugs are biting me, I'm out of breath, I'm chugging up a golf on a spur ridge, and I get lost, and find my way back. And I come up on this clearing, and the fire's on the other side of it. Here comes a twin beach from Cave. These two guys pop out, and they sail down, and they land. They pull off their jump gear, and they're not even sweating. I think, you know, I want me one of those jobs where I only walk down. So that's kind of what got me into it.
It's very similar for me. The first year I was in the Forest Service was 1956. That year, Ken Purcell and I had hitchhiked out from Georgia to jobs in Idaho. I was going to Riggins, he was going to Grangeville, and when we got to Riggins, we parted. He went on to Grangeville. We didn't see each other all summer. When we got back together in the fall to hitchhike back to Georgia, about the first thing that either of us, that we spoke about after we waved and recognized each other was, hey man, next year let's come back and be smoke jumpers. During that summer, both of us had gone to fires that we had done very much like you, Herb. We'd hiked up 4 or 5 miles carrying packs and all of our gear up to the top to find that there's some guys up there lounging around. They've already got a line around this fire, and they're sipping on juice, and they're waiting for us to arrive so that they can leave and go back and get back on the jump list and go back and fight another fire. I said, this is the way to fight fire. And so Ken and I, when we got back to Georgia that next winter, we filled out applications and put in the same envelope and sent them off. Said either they accept both of us or they accept neither one of us, and we lucked out. They accepted both of us for the next year.
How well do you remember your first training jump?
First training jump for me was really not very memorable because it worked just, everything happened just as it was predicted. It was a travel air. It was on Upper Sherman, as I recall, and the opening was not memorable. The landing, there was no wind that day. Landed very close to the spot, in fact. Probably within about 15 feet of the spot. Not close enough to win the jump pot, but it was close. And the body did the Allen roll the way it was trained to do, and it was really not much to be remembered. The second jump, though, was a real eye-opener because the wind had picked up and I didn't handle the chute right, and I hit and I hurt myself. Not seriously, but it made a believer out of me, and I was never again. I always was careful about landing after my second jump. The first one was not very memorable.
Yeah, I was last man out of the four. First jump, and second man, and two men stood together. I remember the thing that really, the guys were sitting in the airplane and kind of turning back over their shoulder and saying, if I freeze, push me. And I was the last guy, and there wasn't anybody left to push me. And I was, the only thing I was worried about is that I would just kind of hesitate like you do on a high board, you know, and I'd be slow getting out. But when the time came, I was also concerned about hitting that little bitty step under the door on the forward from the number two position. And I stomped down and I hit that step. I stood up, and as I recall, I was actually standing on the step outside the airplane with my arms folded, just like I was supposed to, and I'm not really sure if I jumped or fell, but I got out anyhow, and I did hit the ground. I sprained my ankle just a little bit, but Bob, didn't we jump on the third of July? Wasn't that our first time?
Looking back through my letter here, I know I have it recorded here.
Yeah, because it seems like that.
7th of July, I'm saying tomorrow, is number three.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that was it. I think we had a couple of three days off between the first jump and the second jump that kind of gave you enough time to heal up. Of course, it gave you enough time to think about it some, too. I remember saying, Lord, get me out of this one. I'll never try it again.
What about fire jump? When was the first one?
First one was over on the Nez Perce with Chuck Tribe with the two-manner, and it was almost anticlimactic. No wind. Jumped down a little saddle with brush in it. Had a big snag burning. The only thing we had was a little unusual was putting out. We had a crosscut, or we had a power saw. We needed a crosscut because the snag was so big. We put out signals for a crosscut. They dropped us another power saw, and they kept doing this repeatedly, and we ended up with three power saws and no crosscut. Decided if I ever wanted to go into the power saw business, I'll just go out in the woods and put out streamers for a crosscut. So we had a bunch of them out there. We eventually got it out. But Bob, did you go? Were you on that thing? This I believe it was the same day we made a graduation jump where they took us down to Seven Devils on that dry run.
No, I didn't make a dry run until I met my first. Jump was out of the Ford, but it was my first launch forest fire. And I remember it was down in the Selway Bitterroot Primitive area. Ford tri-motor, Bob Johnson was at the controls, and on the way down, he took us on a little diversionary route to see some views. We flew in El Capitan. It's kind of got a car a glacial cirque in one side of it, and I remember that we actually, as I recall, we flew into the cirque, and we turned it, the Ford up on its wingtip, and we just did a 180 and came back out, and that was more impressive really than the fire jump, I think. My first fire jump was south of Salmon Mountain in Magruder District. We had about two or three acre fire in a rock slide. I did hang up, as I recall. We jumped in reproduction. It was not a very high hang up. And we walked out about 12 miles to Salmon Mountain. The truck wasn't waiting for us, and I walked up to the, I remember walking up to the lookout to call in on the telephone to tell them where we were, and they sent the truck for us. And we got into Magruder District, and that was into the ranger station, and I had a chance to see my old buddy from Riggins from the year before, who had been my assistant ranger there. He was now the ranger at Magruder, Dale Thacker. And he was surprised to see me being a jumper, because the last time he'd seen me, I was just a brush piler at Riggins the year before.
Was it everything that you thought it was going to be, that first jump?
The first fire jump?
Yeah.
It was very much what I anticipated. It was the old, I don't know, nowadays I look out here and I don't see any Ford tri-motor sitting around. You know, I think we're not really smoke jumping now. You had to jump out of a Ford tri-motor for your first fire jump for it to really be real. And I think it was just exactly what I anticipated.
Probably with Bob Johnson flying.
Yeah.
What kind of reaction did you get from your family when you told them you were going to be smoke jumping?
My dad was all for it. My mother was a little concerned. As a matter of fact, my dad signed the form before my mother got hold of it. We were talking about it. But they, once things got going on, they were pretty, I think they were kind of proud of it.
For me, my father had died the year before. He had died when I was a freshman in college. And he had been a forester. He never worked out west. He worked in the TVA, Tennessee Valley, back in the 30s. But we were kind of forestry-oriented, and my mom was all for my working for the Forest Service. She didn't know what smoke jumping was. Just didn't, I think, register with her what it would involve. But she was supportive of anything that I wanted to do, and didn't try to discourage me.
Did you ever see anybody make any mistakes during training that really struck you as being dumb?
Are we up to you watching me jump on Kelly Mountain? Yeah.
No, it's during training.
you remember Rolf on the what was it, his jump, John Rolf? When he's streaming?
No.
Now that wasn't dumb. You know, you wouldn't say that, but he went down behind the ridge with a streamer and nothing, we didn't see anything else. And he threw his reserve just before he went into the trees, as I remember. And he put one canopy over one tree, one canopy over another, broke off a couple of big pines, and when we got over there to him, we expected to find him bounced. And he was sitting there in a big pile of brush with a spring.
I don't remember that at all. I can't recall. We all made mistakes.
Oh,
that's a part of being a student. You just learn how to survive your mistakes. That's the main thing of the training we went through. But I don't remember any specific ones.
Remember Norley hooked up in the door and ready to go with the static line left around his arm.
It wasn't a training jump.
Is that a fire jump?
No, I'm thinking about who was it that got towed underneath the plane for?
Oh, Mike McKinnon.
Mike McKinnon. That wasn't a training jump, though.
No, that was a fire jump in 61.
What happened there?
You may not get a record of this, but he got towed under the aircraft for something like 10 or 15 minutes because one of his web straps hung up as twin beats. Between the door facing and the step somehow. There was a piece of, or two pieces of metal came together, and a piece of his web strap actually caught in that, and when he went out, that held him. And so he hung under the aircraft. They couldn't pull him back in.
And they were losing altitude. They feathered an engine, so because it was beating him against the bottom of the airplane. And because the engine was feathered, they kept losing
altitude. Yeah.
And they were too low to cut him loose. And I forgot who he said the pilot was on, but he was working it down there.
It was the guy with the withered arm, I think, as I recall. Yeah. Can't remember his name now. He kind of walked with a limp and had a withered arm. But anyway, he got into a drainage that was going down, and they managed to stabilize the altitude of the aircraft. And so as the terrain dropped away, they got more altitude. And finally, when they got enough where they thought he would have enough to survive, they cut what was holding him, and his chute deployed normally, and he came to the ground, but he was 15 or 20 miles from where he was supposed to be.
And kind of beat to hell.
Yeah. It was really an experience. That was Mike McKinnon, class of 1957.
Any of you guys ever get hurt jumping?
Yeah, I busted my pelvis in a killer.
How'd that happen?
Well, it's kind of a long story. We went out there and we had some guys on the ground already, had a fire going over the hill on pretty badly. It was over just where the Salmon River turns north and heads up in that little bend there. And we had a heck of a surface. In fact, Bob was on the jump too, and he was astute enough not to get hurt, which a lot of us weren't.
Lucky.
And but we had about, from about 200 feet down, we had a hell of a wind. We must have had a 40 knot wind, maybe about 40 knots. And from there on up, it was calm. And we had 16 guys in the dug. And out of the 16, there were five guys that got busted up. And we, I was a rookie. It was my fourth fire jump. And I was number three out of the dug. And D. Dutton was spotting, and Connie Orr was assistant spotter. And I, in looking back on it, it was a typical dumb rookie mistake. You know, I didn't understand the instructions, and I didn't want to say repeat them again because I didn't want to look stupid, and I figured I'd just wing it and be okay. And I guess what D was telling the guys, there's a lookout tower way upwind, and he said, go out, turn to that lookout tower. You remember that lookout tower right above?
Yeah, on top of the ridge, yeah.
Yeah, and said, hold into that sucker and keep going. And the guys that did that blew right back in and came in pretty well. But I got out and I didn't have any wind, and I just held down a guideline, and I was coming down right over the spot. And these other two guys were going way over the horizon. I thought, man, are they ever going to get yelled at? You know, they got to be 10 miles from the fire. And sure enough, I hit that wind, and they started coming back into the spot. And I started just really, really making knots downwind toward the river. And I was looking under my arm, and I saw a whole bunch of stuff coming up, an old burn with a lot of down timber and rocks and stumps and stuff in it. And I made another stupid mistake, and I decided if I turned turned around, that I would be able to clear that, and then I'd be able to turn back and land. Well, the first place I turned around with the wind and added the speed of the chute to my the speed I would have had otherwise. And the second dumb thing is if I had it deep cleared it, I'd have been over into the river canyon. I don't know what would happen. But anyhow, I plowed into this thing going warp four, and kind of, if the FAA medical people are hearing this, I did not lose consciousness. I was, it got my attention pretty well, and I got up from it, and some of the guys helped me out of it, and I staggered around on the fire for a while, and leg locked up on me, and they took us in a chopper the next morning down at Rangeville. And the doctor, I don't believe x-rayed me. He just said if you had anything hurt in there, couldn't walk. So I bumbled around for a couple of weeks, and I convinced myself that I ought to get back on the jump list. And they said that I couldn't get back on the jump list unless I'd run the obstacle course. And so I went out and ran the obstacle course, and when I finished up the obstacle course, I was kind of a basket case, and they took me into the hospital and x-rayed me, and I had a little crack in my pelvis, and so they laid me out in the same place for a couple of 3 weeks or something.
Well, I was on that same fire. Looking at my jump record here, that was the 11th of August, 1957. It was my third fire jump. And as I recall, there were 54 jumpers total that went on that fire. And we had them out of Grangeville, McCall, and as well as Missoula. We had a regular orbit of aircraft up there for a while. The next morning, they came over and they dropped two more guys, as I recall.
I think they dropped, didn't they drop all of the Grangeville guys the next day? They dropped a Ford and a Kia.
But the fire was already lying.
It was just perfectly calm and beautiful.
But it was, you started this with the question about injuries. It was the one jump where I should have been injured. I never was injured in 42 jumps for the Forest Service, but I certainly should have been on this one because I did everything stupid. Was very lucky that I didn't. I had one of the old white shoes. Most of the people were jumping the candy stripes. They were relatively new then. We had some of the old white shoes. White chute seemed for some reason to be slower in maneuvering, and I managed to get mine turned downwind and could never get it to come back to face into the wind. And I was weather vane down, I was going downslope at least 30, 35 knots, and it was a rocky slope. And when I hit, I remember I rolled up, I hit so fast that my chute kind of stopped, but I continued and rolled up in the parachute and knocked the leg pocket off rope pocket off the side of my leg, and my hard hat, which was inside my bird nest coil in the rope pocket, was mashed shut so that I couldn't put it on my head. My camera was inside my hard hat, and it never has worked right ever since that. My camera was injured on Kelly Mountain. It was a very memorable fire.
What would you say, how would you characterize the safety record of the Smoke Jumpers organization?
Amazingly good.
Incredible, yeah.
Considering what you're doing, because since then, I've had a lot of military parachute jumping, and you don't jump into conditions like we did in the Forest Service in the military. You just don't do it because it's too unpredictable. You can't tell what you're going to get into. For having jumped into areas where you cannot have somebody physically on the ground to make sure that the landing spot is safe, to have had the record that the Forest Service maintains, it speaks very highly for luck or somebody looking out for us or something. I don't know.
I think one thing that Bob's jumped at a lot higher level with military than I have. I just went through Benning when I was in the Air Force, got airborne qualified. But to me, the training that we had, just as an entry-level qualifying jumper, the training we had in the Forest Service was just so far superior to what we had.
I agree.
They really taught you to jump, and I think that was the secret, the equipment and the training.
They taught you how to do it in the Forest Service rather than teaching you that basically it's something to get afraid of. Military jumper is afraid to jump, but a Forest Service jumper is... The jumping is a technique to get you to a fire economically, quickly, and the fear aspect of it is not overblown like it is in the military.
you ever jump from other bases other than Missoula?
Yes. Not as a home base, but I spent in 1960, I started off in Silver City, spent the full season down there, and then at the end of that season, this was after I had graduated from college, and so I didn't have to get back for school, so I went to Reading and ended up this season down there in 1960. I also made individual jumps out of Cave Junction, out of McCall.
Is there a rivalry between jumpers from different bases when they get together?
On a friendly basis, there's a certain camaraderie that overrides all of it, but sure, there's rivalry. Every base is best.
Is there
from that base?
Point of pride is to see who's the best man out on the fire? If it's a guy from Missoula, a guy from Silver City, or...
On the fire, you can't distinguish between where they're from. I don't think there's... It's all in the bars where the competition is. When you get on the fire, the competition doesn't exist, and it's just a matter of professionalism.
I think it's more deal of everybody's a smoke jumper. Mm-hmm. We saw that an awful lot if you were on the on fires where there were ground pounders on the fire too. You know, people that the jumpers would just absolutely bust their butt and put in more line than ground pounders.
Yeah, there was a lot of competition between ground pounders, between non-jumpers and jumpers.
Were you ever based with those guys? Staying in the same place with them?
On project.
And it very much like my feelings in 1956 before I came to the jumpers, you know, I remember my attitude toward jumpers. They were kind of like little gods, you know. And you could see that on the part of the guys that you'd be around. There was a certain respect for smoke jumpers, undeniably.
We got along with them real well on project, I think. And I don't think that, I would say that if we ran into anything on the project, you occasionally get some of the real old timers that were a little bit, not antagonistic toward the jumpers, but they possibly were a little bit envious.
I think that's probably the root of it. The younger guys, I think they kind of maybe held out the hope that they could be jumpers sometimes. You didn't get the antagonism. The old guys knew they would never be jumpers, and they thought we were kind of upstarts, I guess. Also because we were college educated. Most of the, I was talking with Ray Skank last night, and he reminded me of a fire that we went on down in out of Reading, where we ran into a bunch of local loggers who had walked in and were fighting the same fire we were on. And in the conversation, now Ray had been an old logger, and so he had a certain understanding with these loggers. He could talk in terms that they talked. And so they were conversing after we'd kind of gotten a line around the thing and had a quiet spot. Somehow the subject came up that these guys that Ray was with, we had about a dozen jumpers on the fire, and he said, well, out of these guys, we probably have... 10 at least that are, eight or 10 that are college graduates, maybe a couple that have master's degrees, and the others are working on college degrees. And one of the loggers looks at him and says, my son had told me he wanted to be go to college, and you guys not do anything that we don't do. He doesn't need to go to college to do this, and so I'm going to go home and I'm going to knock shit out of him.
Makes sense to me.
He says, I'm not going to spend money to, and he was serious. He's serious. He couldn't see spending the money to send this kid to college if all he was going to do is come back and fight fire.
Were most of the guys you jumped with at the time college students?
Yeah, most of them. There were several from Missoula and around this part of Montana that were not, but most of the guys that came from away were either college students or college graduates, maybe a lot of teachers. Who had the summer off automatically and came to do this during the summer.
How did you feel about having to do project work?
Everybody would always rather stay in Missoula and wait for the fires, come in and party, have a good time. But once you got out on the projects, I really sort of enjoyed most of them.
it took you away from the shit details around here. There were these little things to just to keep you occupied. You know, you couldn't just be around Missoula and lay in your bunk all day. You had to be productive, and there just wasn't that much stuff to be done.
Like one of the guys said yesterday out there, he said, "I can't believe it. They're still dandelions on this lawn."
Yeah, and I know I dug every one of them.
Must have declared them an endangered species.
Digging dandelions with a spoon from the kitchen over there. I think everybody in our age group remembers doing that.
And we were talking this morning about Bob Donald coming around. You know, one of the big games between the buck jumpers and the overhead was to, you know, guys would kind of hide out. You know, I don't think anybody would have done it if it hadn't been a game. It's like Black Max says. He says, "I consider myself as a big game hunter. You guys as the big game." You know, try to find some place to squirrel away.
Now, going on project, your question was about project. Project was something that we didn't look forward to because it meant that we weren't going to be fire jumping. That was our primary job. You couldn't jump when you're on project. But it was better if there was going to be no jumping. It was better to be out on project than to be around here trying to look busy.
Yeah, you usually had something productive to do, and getting with the district people, we had, you know, that's some of my fondest memories of some of the projects.
Is there any project work that you really despised?
No.
I think that a lot of what I would despise is if a district would request some jumpers, and you get there, and it was obvious that they didn't really have anything for you to do. They just thought it'd be nice to have some people around. And they put you doing then the same type of thing that you'd be doing at the AFD if you'd stay.
I remember doing some brush piling as a piler on project in the rain in miserable conditions, and there would have been a lot better things to do.
We might have been on that together.
It was over in east of here in Idaho.
Yeah.
Can't think of the name of the.
I can't remember now.
District now.
Yeah, but it was. It rained every day. You think, you know, as far as project, I probably ought to tell him about the heart-shaped garbage board. Just because it's such a stupid thing, because it just reverberated all the way, I think, to regional headquarters. We were, Bill Murphy and, three of us, Bill, and I'll think the same thing. But we were over on the Shearer Guard Station on Moose Creek District. And there was an old guy over there that was running the guard station that really didn't much like jumpers. And he really didn't know what we were doing in there. And he let us know that he wasn't too happy with our work. He said, "Gee, why not?" And, you know, we're getting up early and we're starting early. We're finishing late. But in a good day's work, we're getting a lot done. He said, "Yeah, but you're just not putting the heart in your work." And our next project was to dig a garbage pit, so we dug it heart-shaped. And that was... And for some reason, that pissed that guy off just all out of proportion to what we got. He goes back to the AFD and tells them about it, and they get all mad at us, and we got back. And end result was, Jim Pickett was the other guy, we all three came back in, jumped a fire, and we had to go back in there and do penance. You know, we had to go in and do our time in purgatory, we had to go back for another 3 weeks, just to, you know, to prove that we were really good guys and weren't going to do anything like that.
The heart-shaped garbage pit is probably more famous than a lot of other things that probably deserve to be remembered. I've heard that story several times.
Do you ever have any trouble with planes while you're in the air?
Planes? No. You mean like like one had a mechanical problem?
Down. Yeah.
No. Well, I don't recall one.
Is that pretty rare?
I think it reflects very highly on the maintenance standards of Johnson's Flying Service.
Absolutely.
And considering the old aircraft we were jumping, I can't recall having been delayed on a takeoff because of a maintenance problem or having a problem in the air after we got airborne.
Yeah, I think the amazing thing, talking about the type of airplanes, you know, I'm a professional pilot now and have been for a lot of years, and to look back on this equipment operating and that they didn't have more problems is absolutely phenomenal. Just where do you come up with the parts for those 450s on that Ford?
You know, machine them.
you just machine them, you make your own. Those guys just really do a fantastic job in short bursts of time.
Ford Tri-Motor, how was that for its day?
We were quite a while after its day, but we were still using it. It was good for getting in and out of places. It was, even for smoke jumping, it was so slow. You know, it took you some time.
Slow getting someplace. Yeah, it was good for jumping, but it took you an awful long time to get from here to the bitter, or just to get anywhere. The aircraft they're using today are probably better, although they're not nearly as glamorous.
Yeah, even the Doug was in the beach. Get there so much faster. Fun job, though.
Remember the largest fire you fought?
Scalcaco?
Yeah, once there, that was 59, wasn't it? I want there, 57.
I think probably the one that's still the most memorable of the large fires was the one on Kelly Mountain. Scalpaho was a big one that was in the Bitterroot. That was in 60. I don't remember how big it was. We had several pretty big fires down in California but you don't really, when you're down the fire line, you don't realize, if it's over 100 acres, you really don't realize how big it is. It's just a big fire. Mm-hmm. It could be 5,000 acres, 10,000 acres, you wouldn't know the difference.
You're not aware of how many men are out there?
No. One of the big fires, I remember a big fire I was on, was in Yellowstone. We went down and jumped one in Yellowstone. 22nd of July, 1960 was it. And I remember the big camps of ground pounders that we had to contend with, had to stand in line to get food to them. That was the aspect that I remember most of, though. It's just a lot of people I didn't know were ahead of me in the line to get chow, and I didn't understand why.
Is there any part of the country that you like jumping down to more than any other?
I liked the Gila. The Gila was, we were more on our own, I guess, there than for some reason up here in Region 1. I like any of the primitive areas. Selway, Bitterroot, I especially like Moose Creek and Magruder because I spent another summer when I wasn't jumping on a fire tower in Magruder, and to get back in there was like coming back home.
I kind of like jumping the bomb. It was usually the country was so interesting over there, and you got some really interesting walkouts. You got long walkouts. You got to see some neat things. So, man, that was about it.
You ever had any really long packouts?
Yeah. Not a long pack out, but a long walk out. I had one that we measured it on the map after we got back, just counting sections to measure the distance, and it was 28 miles. That one was in Moose Creek. It happened to be the one that resulted. There were two of us, Roland Perro and myself. And I can tell you that the date on that was... I guess that was the 2nd of August, 1959. I thought it was a different date than that. Isaac Lake, we jumped in. It was, I remember we were met by mosquitoes before we even got to the ground. It was one of those little moose meadows that was just almost like you hear about Alaska, the bugs. We had to run into the smoke of the fire to get away from them. Then we walked out the 28 miles. We were supposed to have been picked up by a helicopter en route. They had showed us on the map where they would stop. They would pick us up. And when we got to that point, there was no way, there was no spot that the helicopter could come into. And we waited around for an hour or so, and there was no sound of a helicopter. And we said, we know where Moose Creek is. We're going to continue. And we ended up, walking and got out about close to midnight into Moose Creek Ranch and woke them up. And they gave us some food because we hadn't bought enough food with us. We thought we weren't going to be going very far. We were really starved by the time we got there. And the next morning, we walked over to the Moose Creek Ranger Station to wait for the aircraft to come pick us up. And that was the Ford that came in that crashed on landing and killed the two jumpers and the forest supervisor the next day.
Long packouts?
Yeah. Okay. Well, I know you want to get back to that with Bob. Crash. The longest one I've ever had, one of the most enjoyable things I've done with the Forest Service is we were down past Pentagon Mountain in the Bob, and we got to go out to up to Hungry Horse, and they needed us pretty badly. So they started out saddle string, and we started walking at the same time. We were walking north, and they were sending the saddle string south. And we walked pretty close to 25 miles and met the saddle string and rode out about another 20. And that was about my longest. Got it started before daylight and ended up after dark, of course. Flew back to Missoula and jumped fire the next day.
Let's go back to the accident there at Moose Creek. What happened?
Well, it was about almost noon by the time the aircraft came to pick us up. I think he'd had a couple stops someplace else to do other things. And I remember we were laying on the, just kind of lounging on the ground outside the front door of the dispatch cabin there at Moose Creek. And he circled over us to look at the windsock, I presume, at altitude. He came over, I watched him make a lazy circle, and he went back down canyon to come up for a landing approach. And he really wasn't paying much attention to it until he was already on the strip. He touched down but was moving up pretty fast up the strip. I wasn't watching until I heard him. I heard the engine race, and it turned out later, I found from talking with the pilots, I guess, that he had realized he was not going to be able to stop with the brakes before he got to the end, so he had attempted to ground loop the aircraft and had gunned the left outboard engine, and it didn't ground loop. It didn't turn the aircraft on its longitudinal axis as he thought it would, and all it did was force them into the trees at the end of the runway a little bit harder than they would have gone otherwise. At the end, right where they hit the trees at the end of the runway, there was a storage, as I recall, of 55-gallon drums of gasoline that were there pre-positioned for helicopter use, I think. Very bad place on as we think about it now, for putting fuel, because he ran right into it, and that just added to the flames. As soon as it hit, it was just a whoomp, and the gas, there was a big, huge ball of fire. And we weren't anticipating anything like this, and I just didn't see how anybody could possibly come out of something like that. I knew there had to be people in there, but didn't think that anybody could get out of it. And then after it kind of died down a little bit, we could see the these figures that were kind of flaming that were coming out on the left-hand side of the aircraft. I was located on the left-hand side of the aircraft. And we ran down and did our best to get them back, to pull them out of the flames and pull them back up where it was safe, where it was away from the flame, I should say. But the two guys there were only two of them that I saw at that time. Both of those guys were totally burned third degree. I couldn't recognize them. I didn't know, had no idea who they were. Clothes had all been burned off except for their boots. They were wearing logger boots. As it turned out, both of those guys were smoke jumpers, and they both died within hours. One of them, Gary Williams, was a new guy that year, and he, I suppose, lived for about 45 minutes while I was trying to encourage him to breathe. It was hopeless, you know. It was really I didn't know what to do, because his skin across his chest was tightening as it just became all hard because of the burns, the charred. He couldn't expand his chest to breathe, and I was trying to give him. I was trying to raise his body, you know, rhythmically so he could breathe. And he was in quite a bit of pain, of course, obviously, and finally passed out and died. We didn't talk very much. He just asked if anybody had Demerol. He wanted something, but there was nothing like that to give him. And after he had died, the other burned guy was across the wooden fence from where I was. It was one of the, it was like a paddock fence that separated where I was with this guy and where the other guy was. They put him in the shade over there. And I was talking with somebody there. The other guy heard my voice, and it turned out it was John Rawl, the other jumper that was burned. He was still living, and he heard my voice and called to me. We were very good friends, and we had planned to hitchhike home that fall together back to the East Coast. He was from New York, and I was from Georgia. We were going to hitchhike someplace to the East Coast and then separate and go our separate ways. But as I say, we were very good friends. We'd gone through training together in 57. And he was probably the most thoughtful member of our entire class. He was the guy that had arranged to have our class photo made, our jump group photo made, and was always thinking about other people. Well, he continued to think about other people at that time because he called me over. He wanted to talk to me. He wanted to tell me what he wanted done with his belongings. He knew he was dying. He knew he could not survive. And he had never made a will, apparently. And so he told me all the little things that he had. I don't remember the details of it now. I passed it along to the supervisors when I got back. But he specified, you know, this is to go to my sister, this is to go to my brother, and he had a girlfriend that he was supposed, they were engaged, and he had certain instructions for her, as I recall. And then he did live long enough. They took him, they air-vacked him with a little aircraft, came in, they took him to Grangeville. I think he lived maybe 6 hours or something like that.
Was that a Johnson Brothers plane?
Yeah, it was one of the Fords. Yeah, Johnson Brothers Ford.
Do you know who the pilot was?
I didn't know the pilot. Fred Brower told me the other day what his name was, and I don't remember. Now, there was a third guy that was killed in that crash, too. There was a Forest Service supervisor who died several days later in the hospital in Missoula because, I think it was in Missoula, of complications because I think there was a, his body reacted to the antibiotics. He got infections in his burns and died several days later.
How did the rest of the guys at the base react when this happened?
Everybody took it very hard because it was the first jumpers that from Missoula that had died since Man Gulch. And it was almost exactly 10 years to the day. We took it as kind of an omen. Man Gulch was in, what was the date? July the 12th, they said, or something like that?
I don't know.
I think they told us this morning at the memorial service, I think it was July 12th, and this was August the 3rd or something. Just a few days past, 10 years exactly after Man Gulch.
I think that too, John was so well thought of in our class, and but none of us knew Gary that well because he was a rookie. But John was, well, for example, he was saving up money to, his parents were German immigrants, I believe, and he was saving up money to send his parents back on a trip to Germany. And just a great guy. I think there was an element, though, that I don't quite know how to put it. But the people were, they realized that there were certain dangers in the job. And it was the type of thing that you were sorry it happened to the guy. You felt sorry for him, but you realized that we all were putting ourselves in a position where that kind of thing could happen. And if it happens, it happens. And you know that those guys wouldn't want us to sit around and dwell over it. So there was that element.
Then we'll stop here and turn the tape over, guys, all right?
Okay.
Okay, we were talking about the plane accident there. Did it ever enter any guy's mind that, you know, that could have been me, and they got the hell out? They decided they didn't want to jump anymore?
No, I don't think anybody. That was something that we acknowledged could happen at any time, and just the fact that it did happen wouldn't cause someone, I think, to turn in his jump boots. There's some more facts of that, though, that I'd like to have recorded here. There was a third smoke jumper on board the aircraft named Ron Stolson. I don't know why he did what he did. He came out of the aircraft through the door. The two guys who, the two jumpers who were in the cargo compartment who got killed came out through a break in the wall of the aircraft on the left-hand side and got tangled up in the control cables on their way out from under the aircraft wing. And in process, the flaming gasoline fell down on them. Now, the door of the aircraft was obstructed. From talking with Stolson later, I found out that there had been a tree fell across it. When the aircraft had gone into the trees, it had sheared off a live pine tree, the top of which had fallen alongside the aircraft, and the flaming top of the tree was right across the door. You know, they don't have doors on the aircraft. It's just an open door with a strap across it for safety. Stolson elected to push that tree aside, that flaming tree. It turned out it was not very, very substantial. He could push it aside with his hands, and then he went out through the door itself. If the other guys had done that, they probably preceded him out through the other side. They probably were not still in the aircraft. But that's what saved him. He went out through the door. He got burned somewhat, second-degree burns, I think, but he had scars for the rest of the season. We saw him. He was sort of walking reminder of the accident there.
Do they teach you in training first aid, medical treatment, any kind?
Oh yes, yeah, that's part of the smoke jumper training. In fact, there's a good bit of it because not only are we smoke jumpers, we're rescue jumpers also. We do have the occasional in the backcountry accident where somebody is injured, and they send smoke jumpers in to take care of them.
You made a lot of rescue jumps.
No, I'd say rescue jumps are about 1 in 100.
Yeah, I never made one. You made one.
I made one rescue jump, but there aren't a lot of them.
The saying, smoke jumpers, work hard and play hard. Do you agree, disagree?
Absolutely. Agree.
Yeah.
Even old smoke jumpers. Still play hard.
Oh, probably harder than you should. Yeah.
You think that your performance the night before might have in any way affected your job the next morning?
I'd like to say no, but I'm afraid on occasion it did. I think at the time I would never have admitted it, but I really think that, you know, when it came up and it was an absolute surprise that you were going to go on fire. You come in at 3 o'clock in the morning and nothing had happened for weeks. And the Doug's sitting out there on the ramp with the props turning over and the lights are all on and you think, oh hell, here we go. Yeah, and it's pretty tough to, you know, you at 19, 20 years old, you force yourself through it.
I don't think it materially reduced our ability to do our job, but it causes a lot, it wasn't nearly as much fun.
That's right.
Fighting a fire when you're in that condition.
You had to push the throttle up to about 110% to get anything.
Of course, there's one aspect. You're carrying more of a water load that you can use to extinguish the initial hot spots.
What would you do with your free time when you weren't out doing project work and you weren't on fires? Cars around town or what?
You didn't want to get away too far. I can recall going up to Glacier Park time or two, Flathead Lake. But only when the conditions were really pretty, when the fire season was very, when the burning index was very low. Stay around pretty close to the base. I remember working hay with some of the ranchers across the highway from the area fire depot just to kind of keep occupied and also augment the income. The money was not the reason we were smoke jumpers, by the way. We didn't get paid all that much.
Yeah, I think what Bob was saying about going away is absolutely true. And if there's anything in the world that would get people back, you know, one lightning strike at night, you see lightning flash one time at night, and all of a sudden, you know, there was the biggest traffic jam in Montana at the entrance to the aerial fire depot, everybody's coming back. It was just the worst thing in the world to get a stone jump. In fact, I've heard of guys actually quitting because they felt that they were unfairly treated on the jump list. Now, if they were put in the wrong place, that's the way it's going to be. I just want to do it.
You hit on something there that I think is pretty significant, and that's the, I don't know if you can watch a lightning storm without having an emotional involvement. I can't. 25 years after, I'm still, every time I see lightning, I think that's the cash register. You know, we used to think that means fires, which mean overtime, which means money in the pocket.
And also something we wouldn't admit at the time, I think, was just that we were going to get to go jump a fire.
Yeah. Well, that's the bottom line, yeah. You get a chance to get a fire jump.
Something else is I go, you know, now I go over the Andes or the Alps or any mountains, any place in the world, and I'm always looking down for a good jump spot.
Yeah.
It's.
For most of the people that were jumping at the same time you were college students, now do you think a lot of things that were going on college campuses affected the Smoke Jumper organization?
Not at our time. We were jumpers before, I think, at least in my campus, before any of the social awareness issues were popular.
Yeah, we were both going to Southeast Conference schools back in the 50s, and I think that's...
Football was big, you know, mm-hmm. Fraternity sorority activities, but the political activism was not big yet.
How did you feel when you heard that they were going to let women smoke jump?
I didn't hear it. Until I got back here. I didn't know that we had women smoke jumpers until I got back for this reunion.
I'll have to say that I kind of hope that they uncharacteristically wouldn't change the requirements. And wouldn't, you know, that they would make the job, if they could make the job requirements absolutely essential and say, okay, you do it, you know, whatever you are, you know, he or she do it exactly the same, meet the requirements precisely the same way. You know, we don't give you anything for it except, like they say, maybe lower the chinning bar so somebody shorter can reach it. But if Doyle Musselman could reach it, anybody could, you know, or Joe Lord. But I kind of hated some of the things I heard that they had slightly changed some of. And I don't know, this is just stuff, but officially on the Forest Service records, no, they didn't change any of the requirements. But I understand that the women were given, for example, considerably more opportunities to pass a physical test than the men. It was just once you pass it or you don't. And the women had several shots. I guess it's, you know, sometimes you think the whole world is, you know, loony six world nothing. And I hate to see this kind of thing come into. It seems like this is too important an organization for the women's revolution to come into it. If indeed these women are capable of doing the job and they can do it on their own, and they can qualify on their own, that's great. Certainly taken, but I think that nobody should be given. You know, Bob and I certainly weren't given the slightest bit of advantage when we came in. Nobody else ever has been in the history of the organization. Not only do I should.
Pretty physically demanding job.
Yeah, absolutely. Probably the most physically demanding U.S. government job that exists is this one. There's another aspect to having women in the outfit. They're women. And there's a certain morale impact here that I don't think a lot of people are willing to recognize, especially when you get down. We have a lot of fires. At least we used to have a lot of what we at that time called two-man fires. I guess now they're two-person fires. But you can have a man and a woman go on a fire, on a two-man fire, and nothing, everything could be totally professional. But the rest of the unit, everybody who's aware of it. There's always that underlying curiosity about what went on, you know. I'm in the military, and we have recently. There's been, you know, a lot of effort for females to be given jobs that would take them into combat. And in the military, we have about come to the, to an agreement, I believe, that to have them there in combat helps us, gives us more people to hold guns, but maybe the negative factor of having a woman over there that everybody's going to be concerned about. The men inevitably are men, and they're going to be concerned about the welfare of their woman cohort, and they are going to be more concerned about seeing that she is not hurt than in doing what their primary job, which is fighting the enemy. And it's the same sort of thing in the smoke chambers. It's almost like a combat situation. And I have three daughters that I hope never have any problem, you know, fitting into the world of equality. But I think this is probably a place where total equality is not recommended.
No. It's a noble.
That's a rambling answer to your question.
Well, it basically, to summarize, it's a no bullshit job. It's a serious job. It's a job you can get hurt at. It's a job you can get your buddy hurt at. And it's just no place for the political bullshit.
Did you ever run into a lot of political BS when you were in the jumpers?
No.
No, not really. We perceive, those of us from the South, now Herb and I are, it's probably obvious from our accents, Herb being from Mississippi and me from Georgia, we perceived a little bit of institutional prejudice against Southerners. I wouldn't call that political. I think it's because most of the overhead out here were from the Northwest, most of them from Montana.
Most of them from the Bitterroot Valley.
Most of them from Missoula. Southerners, maybe rightly, I think wrongly, have seemed to have gotten a reputation out here for being somewhat laid back, you know.
Slow and dull, sort of.
Yeah, you know. And we had to contend with that. We had to kind of more than prove our capability here, I think.
I think so. You had to convince them, you know, don't hurry, we don't have enough time. You know, let's do it slowly. Let's do it maybe a little slower, but let's do it right the first time. Let's don't, you know, ping off the walls doing it wrong time after time. And I think they did perceive us as being a little bit slow working, maybe a little bit slow thinking, because we talked slowly. And it took an awful, it did take something. But I don't think it was as universal. I think there were maybe a few people.
We won't name names.
We won't name names.
We're not talking about you, Lynn Crowley.
How do you see the future of the smoke jumpers?
After last night, listening to the head of the Forest Service, I'm not sure. He kind of waffled that.
Yeah, he did a little bit. He says, well, as far as I can see, nothing else happens.
I think he said that he thought that probably we'd have smoke jumpers maybe doing our job a little bit differently. Maybe without parachutes. I kind of took that until the end of the century, but I don't know. When you lost a Ford Tri-Motor, it's all downhill from there.
Well, one thing seriously they are getting into is they get some airplanes now that are really expensive to operate. And I don't, you know, the amount of money it takes to put a man on a fire. We could have been using helicopters a long time ago, except for the cost factor, I think. And now if we're getting to the point where you're talking about a Twin Otter is, you know, several million dollars.
Really?
Yeah, very expensive to operate. And maybe between a million and 2 million. And you're talking about some pretty high power. And, you know, they can't go back to the Dugs. The Dugs are getting old for safety reasons and so forth. But on the other hand, the real helicopters aren't like Blue Thunder. You know, they're very limited in what they can really do. And there's, you know, if anything, we're getting more and more wilderness area here after year. So more and more need somebody to get back in there sometime.
But technology may do away with us. I tend to stick my head in the sand on this, so I hope it doesn't happen. I think it's a great opportunity for a young kid, and I would hate to see this. Maybe he doesn't ever become a smoke jumper, but just knowing that there was the opportunity that he could have tried to become a smoke jumper is sort of like wilderness area. Most of the people in the United States never have seen wilderness area. Maybe flew over it, but they've never been out in it. People who support wilderness concept, just because they know it's there, knowing that that there's really wild country out there. Same thing with jumpers. Knowing that we have that kind of an organization, that if I really wanted to work hard enough, I could possibly become one of those guys. If we ever lost them and didn't have that opportunity, I think we've lost something that's bigger than it appears.
Yeah, I almost think, for example, the military continues to have an airborne program. I think that's part of the reason they did that. Because we had one airborne assault in Vietnam. It was a total complete failure because the VC chose not to attend. And this is the kind of thing that the days of, you know, of blackening the skies with parachutes are pretty much over in the military. I really think they kind of keep running that jump school more or less.
From morale factor.
Yeah.
How do you feel about the guys who have turned smoke jumping into a career?
Right.
They make it tough on a young kid who wants to come in and do it for just a couple of summers because the slot's not available. I noticed that it's very apparent now. Well, they had 17 trainees this year. Last year, I think they said they had no trainees. They didn't even have a new man class last year. That means that there's a lot of young kids out there who would like to be smoke jumpers that don't have the opportunity. Probably technically they're more competent firefighters. If you're looking at the getting the job done, having the professional smoke jumper probably is an increment better. For the purposes of meeting the needs of national morale, to have this kind of an organization available is probably not good.
It's great training for guys that are majoring in forestry too. Things that they're going to take with them through their career in the Forest Service. We have an awful lot of reggies right now, you know, guys that stay with the Forest Service. Now it's improved there. So for that reason, but if some guy wants to make a career, you know, so I don't know what you do all the time.
You feel that your experience as a smoke jumper helped you out in your later life?
Unquestionably, it straightened me out. I'm personally a little bit unique because I had a split in my, after my first year. I can say this openly now. It felt very strongly about it for a long time. I didn't quite complete my first year. I was invited to resign, to terminate early, because I had some personality difficulties with certain of the squad leaders, one or two of them. And so I was invited to terminate and was not going to be invited back the next year. Wasn't invited back the next year. I had to go back to the forest to prove my mettle again and get a good work record on the forest, which I did. And then I came back two subsequent years after that as a jumper. I think, though, having had that experience, that I realized that I couldn't just do anything I wanted to in life. And I had to finally face up that I was part of civilization and must act to be civilized, and I haven't had any problems along that line since. I think that probably was instrumental in my growing up.
Yeah, I guess it's one thing it did for me is I got thinking about it and decided that if I would stay in airplanes instead of jumping out of them, that the pay was better and I'd stay cleaner and I could probably do it longer. So I did that. But really, it's just, I think, just the it took quite a bit of self-discipline, and it came out of growing up part of everybody's life. You know, to be part of a team, and almost all the cliches that you hear about sports, you know, the same type of thing. And it just really, I think, as a personality building, to build the type of person you're going to be the rest of your life, it was pretty cool.
Well, I think I've just about shot the questions I have to ask. If I missed anything, you want to add?
We want to talk about records and stuff like that.
What kind of records?
Oh, personal things that we did that we think probably are unique in the annals of smoke jumpery.
Sure, go ahead. How many jumps have you made in your career?
In my Forest Service jumping, in the three summers, I made 42 jumps total. I made 22 fire jumps on my last year. That was the year I stayed 6 months. I think that's not I'm sure that's not the highest, but that's pretty high.
Yeah, that same year, boy, does that bring something. I went to Air Force ROTC summer camp over at Fairchild in Spokane, and these guys are all just jumping like crazy, 22 jumps, and I think I got either 6 or 7. I'm sitting over there listening to the radio about the, you know, sky full of parachutes for regional one, and you're over there learning to make a bed with a 6-inch column, marching around. Well, really disheartened.
I made 2 jumps on one day.
I did that once.
2 fire jumps?
Yeah. 60.
In 60. In June.
1960, pretty hot year for jumping.
Sure. Yes, it was. I think I have the record for the smallest fire. Gary Kuiper and I were looking, we were airborne down in New Mexico, looking over the Gila for a smoke that had been reported. We couldn't find it. We fly all around the area trying to pick it up. Spotters couldn't find it. And a little cloud built up over here, and a couple of strikes of lightning went down. So we started studying those, where they hit, you know, very carefully. And sure enough, we saw a tiny little plume of smoke. And got on the radio and reported it and got permission to jump it since we couldn't find the other one. So Gary Kuiper and I hooked up and jumped out. And by the time we got to that fire, it had hit a live tree, and it was smoldering in the duff at the base of the tree out to about 6 inches radius in a semicircle around. This tree was about maybe 12 inches in diameter. And so the fire was burning at maximum from the tree itself and the bark 6 inches, but only halfway around it. We mopped it up and measured it carefully, you know, for the fire report, and reported it as 4 square feet. I think that's generous. I think it was probably 3.
I might have made the last fire jump out of Missoula 4. And I wish I had my jump permits. We went very early fire, 4 of us went over the sandwich. And if I'm not mistaken,
wish we had some of the other guys from our class here sitting with us. We would get a lot, we'd fill out a lot of this stuff from different aspects. I can't think of anything else that would be of interest to the analysts.
Hey, thanks, guys.